Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, back from D.C. Thanks for everyone in the Tony Snow Studios for making that so special. Right off the State of the Union address, had a chance to find out what's going on in Washington, and there's a lot of action there, especially because it's not crippled from snow like here in New York. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Senator James Lankford, who's standing by, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West at the bottom of the hour. A lot of tension on that Republican and Democratic primaries for the Senate seat held by John Cornyn right now. And Zachary Levi will be with us, too, actor and host of the Fox Nation series, David, King of Israel. So before we get to Senator Lankford, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There's a genuine level of support there and respect, and it's a shame that sort of this storyline and narrative is kind of blown up and overshadowing kind of that connection and genuine interest in one another and cheering one another on.
Yep, USA Hockey's gold medal win continues to generate a degree of controversy as the equally amazing women's team awaits their day in the sun and handles the president's joke after the men's win.
Number two.
The negotiations tomorrow and the talks tomorrow will be largely focused on the nuclear program. And we hope progress can be made, because that's the president's preference, to make progress on the diplomatic front.
Yeah, but it's only a small portion of the problems in Iran. All eyes on Geneva to see if Iran will throw themselves on the mercy of the American delegation to avoid a massive conflict, which they will lose with American muscle waiting locked and loaded offshore.
Number one.
The president said this last night. We inherited a mess. Our ask to the American people is, let us continue to fix this mess, make your life better. That's what the president is prioritizing, and that's what we're going to keep doing.
And that's what the J.D. Vance's message is today, taking the State of the Union Act and agenda on the road. Trump and Vance fan out to tout their economic game plan, leading to one big question. Has anyone heard any semblance of an economic game plan from the Democrats? We look at the left fallout, too, from the abhorrent behavior again at the State of the Union. With us right now, a man who did attend and did behave himself, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma. Senator, welcome back.
Yeah, welcome as well back to snowy New York or wherever you landed here to be able to get out of D.C. But I have to tell you, I did behave myself at the State of the Union. I did calisthenics. I did a lot of leg presses up and down to be able to cheer because it was a tremendous night.
I mean, a couple of things. I thought the president really nailed it. I thought it gave you insight, gave you a salute to a lot of great Americans. Highlight for me was, of course, the dramatic entrance of the USA hockey team. All except five attended. But what was surprising to you looking over to the other side of the aisle?
Yeah, the most shocking moment is still the one everyone's talking about, when the president said, okay, it was kind of a level reset. If there's one thing we can all agree on, let's all stand and cheer that we work for the security of the American people, not for illegal aliens. Stand if you agree with that, and no Democrat would stand. It was the most shocking moment of the entire night. And then the other one was when he introduces two Medal of Honor winners, one from World War II in the Korean War, and the other one took an enormous number of rounds in trying to be able to capture and did capture Maduro. And even some Democrats wouldn't even stand for Medal of Honor winners. I mean, so it was just a stunning moment for that.
So the one part of the State of the Union I thought that the speaker might act on, but it might have made them martyrs, was when Tlaib and Omar were just screaming at the president. And Omar evidently was saying KKK. Here's what the speaker said about why he didn't look to expel them. Cut five.
It was shameful, really. And I came this close to stopping them. We could have probably ejected them from the floor. But, you know, I thought let their actions speak for themselves. The president handled it so well, of course. And if they'd gone a step further, we probably would have ejected them. But I think it was good for them to be there. I think it's good for the American people to see the shame that they brought upon their party and upon themselves. And what a stark contrast between them and between the Republican Party. We're standing in cheering for all these great Americans who deserved all this attention tonight.
So, I mean, it did get close. What were you thinking? I mean, that Senator Lankford, that's the exact opposite that you've ever acted in your life. I can't imagine you ever losing it like that. But what were you thinking? Do you think Democrats think they no big deal, or do you think they secretly see that as a problem?
Well, I hope they see that as a problem, but it didn't appear that they did at all. And you probably couldn't tell from the TV side of things, but Tlaib was just talking smack the whole time. If you're in the rooms, you can just hear her constantly talking back to the president over and over again, sometimes louder, sometimes quieter, but this constant banter back and forth with everything that he would say. And I think back about 15 years ago when Joe Wilson responded out to President Obama during one of those joint sessions and said, "You lie," when, by the way, the president did lie about not providing health care for illegal aliens in Obamacare. When Joe Wilson did that, Democrats were just appalled that someone would speak out and to be able to speak against President Obama. And they were just shocked that somebody would make one statement.
I know.
When Tlaib and all those folks were all just yelling at the president the whole night during the State of the Union. And they find absolutely no problem with that as well.
So, Senator Lankford, as you know, I think the main story now that the State of the Union is done is Iran. It looks like talks are happening right now. They took a break for lunch. I'm more concerned if the Iranians go, okay, we'll give up our nuclear program, because we know the nuclear program's not the problem. And we also know that Steve Witkoff was not accurate when he came out and said the nuclear program would take a week to have the bomb. That is not true. And they got to watch that, because people feel as though they were misled maybe in Iraq by overstating a nuclear program. So it was obliterated, and they are trying to rebuild it, perhaps, and it looks like they are, but they're not a week away from a bomb. So what are your greatest concerns as you hear about these talks?
Yeah, they're not a week away from a bomb on it, but they're definitely trying to get to and restart their nuclear program. There's really three big issues here. One is they're the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Terrorism in the entire region in the Middle East and around the world is funded by Iran. They don't take care of their own people. Their philosophical focus is destroy Israel, destroy America, kill all Jews, kill all Western civilization. But they are also, as Shia, they're also focused on destroying Sunni Muslims as well and trying to be able to take over the world. So that philosophy drives paying for the Houthis, paying for Hamas, paying for Hezbollah, paying for Shia militants in Iraq to be able to run their neighbor there. Their focus is their terrorism, number one. Second thing is their ballistic missile program that they have designed to attack our allies and the United States. And then third is their nuclear programs. All three are important. And when it drives me crazy when people will say, hey, this is all about Israel. We have 750,000 Americans that live in that region. 750,000 that live in that region. So we have a lot of Americans that live and work right there in the UAE and Saudi Arabia and in Israel and in Egypt and Jordan. There are a lot of Americans at risk every single day from an Iranian regime that wants to be able to dominate the world. And so the president sparked several thousand tons of diplomacy right off their coast and said, let's talk seriously. And if they're not willing to actually stand down from their terrorism, their missile program, and their nuclear program, then we have to act to be able to protect our interests as Americans.
But this has been our enemy for 47 years. I really think the president would help him to make a speech about it and just run through the 83 Marine barracks bombing, the Khobar Towers in 96, the 600-plus that were killed during the Iraq War, 600-plus Americans, let alone the numbers who have been maimed, how they continue to foment anger towards us and put an assassination and a hit on our president, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, Brian Hook. I think it's important to reiterate that in a separate speech. I don't think it's going to happen.
If we have to actually stop this regime from actually launching what they plan to do on America, the president's going to have to stand up and make that statement publicly. Obviously, during the State of the Union, he spent a chunk of the State of the Union talking about Iran. In fact, he spent more time talking about Iran than he did about Ukraine and Russia and all that's going on there. So he started making the case to say this is a serious issue. This is not just saber rattling. This is a threat to America. And if there's anything we learned from 9/11 years ago, it's a faraway Middle Eastern set of radicals. When they say they want to kill America, they mean it, and we shouldn't just ignore them.
Here's the former prime minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett. I was just on with him with Fox and Friends. Here's what he says he thinks is happening at the talks.
I think Iran is going to try and do what they always do, which is buy time until they're out of the water. There will be no point in history where Iran is at such a vulnerable point where we can get them to make a decision either to stop being a genocidal nuclear terror state or simply the regime will fall because it seems that they won't be able to continue this. So they are at a decision point, and it's vital to not let off on the pressure.
This is, and that's my worry. I don't know how two guys handle the rebuilding of Gaza, Ukraine, Russia, and this. I don't think Ed Kissinger in his prime with a delegation would have trouble with that.
Yeah, they're carrying a lot, and you're correct on what is on their inventory. The president trusts those two a lot, and so he assigns them to more and more to be able to take on. But this issue is incredibly delicate and incredibly difficult and requires a lot of attention of how we're going to actually navigate this, because no American wants to go to war, but we also want to make it clear we're not going to allow you to say that you're going to kill us and actually do it in as many opportunities as you can get, and continue to be able to plan the assassination of American leaders and continue to find a way to kill American troops and to attack us, and to be able to fund the Houthis that are shooting at American ships and fund Hezbollah that are shooting at Americans in the region and fund Hamas, and to be able to say that we're not going to respond to that. We have to find a way to stop that. Diplomacy is by far best. Naftali Bennett is correct. Iran's never been weaker than they are at this point from the severe sanctions, right, and from the elimination of a lot of their air defenses in the 12-day war. This is a moment to bring them to the table and force them to be able to make the hard decisions to say you've got to change, and if you don't, we will change you.
Senator James Lankford, our guest, he's on Homeland Security, Intelligence and Finance Committees. And Senator, I love the fact that Tom Homan is kind of in charge now of how ICE is going to be deployed, at least in Minneapolis. Do you want him to get the rest of that portfolio in Homeland? And do you think there should be a change from Kristi Noem?
I don't. I think Kristi's doing a good job in it. She's got a very, very difficult role to be able to balance. Tom Holman's doing a great job stepping in to Minnesota and setting some of the pace on it. Tom Holman is the border czar and of that individual that's actually there the president talks to all the time to be able to engage on that, does have a very vocal role in how things are going to be done. And as you know, in the White House and across the country, there are a lot of opinions about this issue. All of those opinions are represented on the president's team, and he's listening to all of them all the time and getting that American perspective. The president has been very focused. He wants to stop illegal immigration, and he has. His announcement, even at the State of the Union, we have zero people that are illegals coming into our country now. Zero. That's the number everyone was looking for and to be able to make sure that we have. Now the challenge is, what do we do with the individuals that are here? And the president's trying to be able to articulate clearly, right, Here's how we deal with folks to be removed that are criminal aliens.
I want you to hear something. I could see a strategy unfolding before our eyes, and it's coming from the left. We always say about the cities, you don't have this problem in Tulsa or Oklahoma City, but in most blue cities, they're out of control. People are moving out. It's not my opinion, it's fact. Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, they're moving out. And now people center left are pointing it out, not just Senator Lankford from Oklahoma. Listen to Fareed Zakaria on CNN. Cut 15.
New York is really a prime example of a problem Democrats seem unwilling to confront. Blue cities are out of control. promising more, spending more, delivering less, and pushing off the fiscal problems to some future day. Take Los Angeles, another one-party metropolis wrestling with affordability and disorder. The city's homelessness budget for fiscal year 2025-26 totals about $950 million. The LA Homelessness Services Authority reported that in 2023, homelessness was up 9% countywide and 10% in the city. All this amid public frustration despite billions spent.
And he goes on in every city. I couldn't believe this. And I'm hearing it more and more with, you know, analysts, Democratic analysts. Are they trying to change the narrative? Are they trying to get America ready for a radical change? I wanted the cities to be better, but I always thought that until a Republican's elected, it won't be. But what do you think's happening here?
Yeah, I think a few Democrats have finally said the emperor has no clothes, and they're admitting what everyone can see with their own eyes. Crime is running rampant. Costs are up. They can't continue to be able to pay for all these expensive programs. They've taxed away so much that people have just packed up and moved. Americans vote with their feet before they vote at the ballot box. They'll say, hey, this doesn't fit me and the values of my family, and they'll just pack up and move to a different spot. It's a great thing about the country. States can compete, and they are competing, and red states are winning in that competition because people want to move towards freedom. They want to have a safe place for their family. They want to have good schools. They want to have all those opportunities, and they're packing up and moving to spots where they can experience all that in America.
But Senator, they just elected a socialist here. He's worse than we thought. They have a mayor in Chicago who's got 19% approval rating. Philadelphia's crime's gotten better, but little else. So these are the facts that we figured out. But do you think on the left they're actually going to do something about it?
Yeah, the left will have to make a decision once they hit the bottom. And that's the hard part is, yep, you can have a lot of folks that leave out from these cities. And so all that's left are the crazy leftists. And they vote for the crazier leftists, whoever's more and more saying what they want to say on the Marxist side of things. And they'll find out, like every other nation in the world has found out, this does not work. New York City's experienced this before, where they went through this cycle and then had a series of good mayors and then turned right back around again. So we'll see what happens in the days ahead. But every city's going to have to learn the same hard way that everyone else learns to be able to see when you promise the world and then you get way less than that. You find out that, okay, maybe I shouldn't listen to the promises. Maybe I should listen to reality. Yep. Maybe when somebody says something's too good to be true, maybe it is.
Senator James Lankford, good luck keeping your level head in a crazy town like Washington. Senator James Lankford, thank you. Bottom of the hour, we talk Texas. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West of the Dallas County Republican Chair. Don't move.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. Got just a couple of minutes in a little while. I want you to hear from Alan West about what's happening in Texas. You might have heard Senator Tim Scott, and he's in charge of keeping the Senate red. And he's worried about Texas. He loves Wesley Hunt. He might like Ken Paxton. I don't know if he knows him, but he definitely loves John Cornyn. And whatever you think, Ken Paxton seems to be very popular in Texas. But they say all the stats read that if Ken Paxton gets the nomination, Texas, that Senate seat's in play. And if Texas Senate seat's in play, they have an excellent chance of losing the Senate. Can you imagine what the Trump team would be like with the majority Democrat in the Senate and the majority Democrat in the House? So that's why this primary is so important. Coming up on Tuesday, I think early voting ends in a couple of days. And then we'll see who wins that primary. If it's no one gets 50%, just two will move forward. I love Wesley Hunt, too. But you got to do what wins. So should President Trump just endorse Cornyn, and then he'll just waltz his way to another 6 years? I love John Cornyn.
you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
They didn't say it when I talked to Charlie Kirk, it said the exact same thing. Or the dozens and dozens of other occasions where I've said exactly the same thing. It was a hell of a statement, particularly for people that have been countenancing racism in their party for decades. The same pundit, Sean Hannity, let's call them out by name, that didn't say one word, still haven't said a word, about the racist videos that were put out about Michelle Obama and Barack Obama. Nothing. Not one word of condemnation of President of the United States that put out those racist videos or all countries or the birther issues. Not a word.
So that is Gavin Newsom trying to walk back, not walk back his comments, justify his comments in front of a black mayor and a mixed audience. Just to be honest, they said it's a mixed audience. He came out and said, I'm just like you. I got a 960 on my SATs. I can't read. I'm just like you. I just paraphrase. And the backlash has been tremendous, not just from Sean Hannity, but around the country. People are saying, "Are you cannot be serious," to quote John McEnroe. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West heard those comments, too. He's down at Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director. The president, I know for a fact that President Trump heard those comments and said it is over for Gavin Newsom if it was ever on. What about you, Lieutenant Colonel?
Yeah, I think he just dropped a hand grenade on himself. But look, Brian, this is reflective of the soft bigotry of low expectations from the Marxist leftist, the Democrat Party. Because let's not forget Kathy Hochul, who said that young black kids there in New York City, they don't know how to work a computer. They don't never seen a computer, stuff like that. Or how they say that, you know, blacks are too dumb to be able to get a picture ID. I just flew from, I'm in Panama City Beach right now, for a veterans event. I just got on an airplane. I showed my ID. I guess, is Southwest Airlines racist because they made me show an ID? So, yes, Gavin Newsom is without a doubt done, but they don't have anybody to offer for the United States of America because all of them are, once again, guilty of the soft bigotry of low expectation, to include Kamala Harris, who, you know, said that, again, you know, it's too hard for people in rural areas or for blacks to get picture IDs. That's the most insidious, dumb thing that I ever heard, but that's the nature of who they are.
All right, I want you to hear Howard Enten. Harry Enten on CNN. Cut 14.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me that Gavin Newsom is flailing a little bit, at least compared to where he was prior. Because just take a look here. Okay, Chance Newsom is the 2028 Democrat nominee. 3 months ago, according to the cash prediction market, look at that. It was a 37% chance. Now, it's just a 28%. Down he goes. He's definitely flailing a little bit. And I will note, John, I will note that it also seems to me people are a little less interested in Gavin Newsom than they used to be. Look at this. Google searches for Gavin Newsom down 63% from the August peak. You remember back then it was when he started that social media, right, going after President Trump. There was a lot of interest from Democratic voters, but maybe that interest is waning off just a little bit.
So I think people are realizing this guy is the ultimate phony politician.
Yeah, he is, and there's no doubt about it. And, you know, he goes over there to Europe and he does face plants just the same as AOC did. But I think the bottom line, just look at the state of California. And really, do you think that someone that has caused such gross disasters out there in the state of California, the Pacific Palisades, I mean, have any of those houses been rebuilt to this point? That's the type of person that
almost
you want
none.
To have as president.
Almost none.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how many years? It's been, what, a little over a year, maybe 2 years? Is this the type of person that we want to have? I mean, they didn't have enough water to put out the fires because they're more so concerned about a little tiny delta smelt fish. No. He can talk about how they have the fourth or fifth largest economy, but then let's talk about affordability. Look at the gas prices out there. Look at the housing prices out there. And we know about that in Texas because we see all those California license plates that are coming to the state of Texas.
So I want you to hear, and let's talk about Texas. Senator Tim Scott was on with me. I just told our audience on Friday, you know, he's in charge of the Republican Senatorial Committee. And he says that John Cornyn has the best chance of winning the general and that Ken Paxton doesn't. And he worries him. He's worried about it. He's hoping Trump endorses Cornyn, said it flat out on the show. He also said it looks like John Cornyn is coming out, not mincing words. We'll cut an ad talking about Ken Paxton cheating on his wife and some of the controversies that Democrats are waiting to probably to bring up. Your thoughts about what's happening in Texas and the stakes?
Well, I will tell you that without a doubt, I believe that it's going to go to a runoff. Will it be Ken Paxton against Cornyn, Ken Paxton against Wesley Hunt? But Ken Paxton does have character issues. There's no doubt about it. You cannot hide that. And you know that the left will do everything. It'll just be a negative ad starting the day that he wins the runoff going forward. John Cornyn still has issues with the grassroots because of his support of gun control legislation. That's a big thing to overcome in the state of Texas.
But he does look best. He does look strongest. You know best because you live there. But in the polls, he does look strongest in the general.
Well, the thing is that, you know, across the state of Texas, they're not going to vote for a Tallarico with his woke Jesus campaign, and definitely not for, you know, crazy Jasmine Crockett. So I think that Texas will still continue to have a Republican senator. But is what type of Republican senator will Texas have? I think that's the question going forward. So I wish that the three of them would have had a debate. None of them have agreed to have a debate, and especially Senator Cornyn hasn't. He spent a lot of money bombarding on the ads, and I think a lot of people would like to see him on a debate stage.
So this 40,000 of our troops in and around the region, around Iran, we know we got two aircraft carriers now that the Ford is now in place. Here's Marco Rubio on the stakes on the talks that are taking place right now. They're in a lunch break. Cut 22.
Iran poses a very great threat to the United States and has for a very long time. They are in possession. First and foremost, after their nuclear program was obliterated, they were told not to try to restart it. And here they are. You can see them always trying to rebuild elements of it. They're not enriching right now, but they're trying to get to the point where they ultimately can. The other thing I would point you to, however, is that Iran possesses a very large number of ballistic missiles, particularly short-range ballistic missiles that threaten the United States and our bases in the region and our partners in the region. And all of our bases in the UAE, in Qatar, in Bahrain. And they also possess naval assets that threaten shipping and try to threaten the U.S. Navy.
So all those things, I know you won't dispute anything he said, but the Gang of Eight got briefed yesterday and Jim Himes and Hakeem Jeffries came out and said, I still don't know why we got to do this now. So number one, if you just got briefed, keep your mouth shut, right? You have the highest security clearance for a reason. But your thoughts about where we're heading right now, because you know about America and wars in the Middle East.
Well, I guess Hakeem Jeffries and Jim Himes would prefer to take the Barack Obama approach and send them pallets of cash and unmarked airplanes in the middle of the night, or take the Joe Biden approach. You cannot trust the Iranian regime. I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about the ayatollahs and mullahs. They're not going to try to go into any agreement. Any agreement they go into, they're going to violate it unless there's serious enforcement and serious intervention into this. You need to take away their military capability capacity. I'm talking about the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Basi forces. Take out those ballistic missiles, short, medium range capability that they have, and then let the Iranian people decide who they want to have as a leader. But right now, the number one supporter of Islamic terrorism in the world, they have to be gone. That's just the bottom line. That means Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, you know, all of the dominoes fall. Just the same as what we saw. You take out Nicolas Maduro, look at what has happened in our hemisphere now. Now you see the Cuba and Mexico, even they're starting to step up.
Panama.
So we have to start Panama. We have to start peeling that onion back. And Iran is a very big part. And also understand that Russia is concerned because that's where they get their weaponized drones from, Iran. And China is concerned because that's where they get their shipments of oil. So this is a way that we undermine this new 21st century axis of evil.
So the Iran's, you know, right now, Witkoff and Kushner are talking about the nuclear program, but the other programs are more vital. I think the nuclear program is going to take a long time to rebuild, and I think the Israelis will take it out before they do. So I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about them actually saying we'll go to zero enrichment, because that means they want to survive. They can't survive.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a former prime minister, and it looks like they gave a bill. They gave a, despite their straits where they can't give their people water, and the real is being crushed by the dollar, and they don't have basic, they can't satisfy basic needs. They gave $1 billion to Hezbollah and a little less to Hamas last year. Now, they're really hurting, so I don't know what they're doing in 2026, but this is all related. If you want a semblance of getting along in the Middle East, you can't do it with the Ayatollahs in power.
No, you can't. And again, that shows they don't care about their people. What they care about is their theocracy. What they care about is bringing down Israel. What they care about is bringing down the United States of America. And what they care about is supporting Islamic terrorism. And I think that we have to draw a line in the sand and say no more. And President Trump, he has to do something, because you cannot, you know, have that show of force and not in some way utilize it, because then you look like a paper tiger.
Got it. All eyes on Texas this weekend, and of course on Tuesday, where we'll find out about the primary on the left and the right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Colonel Allen West.
Always a pleasure. God bless. Take care, Brian.
All right, listen, when we come back, Zachary Levi will be with us, actor and host of a brand new Fox series called David, King of Israel.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I have a mission for you. Avenge my enemies. And with victory,
the hand of my daughter, Princess Mikhail.
The Lord's witness to a bond between us.
As long as the son of Jesse is alive, you'll never be king.
So that is a little of the brand new series on Fox Nation. Zachary Levi is with us, actor and host of the series called David, King of Israel. And guess who's here right now? Zachary Levi. And if you're smart enough to watch the stream, look at the smaller cameras. We're getting the big ones ready. So they're going to be ready soon, but then soon we're going to...
Which one's the small one? Right? I don't know. I can see it with the red light
on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See, your instinct takes over.
Yeah.
So great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Established actor. You're on this Fox Nation series, especially here we are in Lent leading up to Easter. Why'd you take this role? And what are you playing in the series?
So I play me. This is very similar to some of the other stuff on Fox Nation, like when Kevin Costner is, you know, kind of talking people. I'm hosting, exactly.
Like Ainsley did on the series.
Exactly. I'm a narrator host to just bring the audience through a four-part docuseries with, you know, cool dramatic reenactments and things like that. But I am just kind of, you know, laying out the story of David, of King David, starting as the young shepherd boy in the fields, tending to his flock, who gets chosen amongst all of his brothers to go be essentially the new king of Israel, of the Israelites, while Saul is losing his mind and he goes off to fight Goliath. I mean, you know, some of these things, I think David and Goliath is something everybody knows, but there's so much more to the story and to his rise as king. And we only kind of scratch the surface. This is, you know, these four episodes only lead us to a certain point. I think the goal, hopefully, is to tell the audience more of this story, you know, should this series do well. And I know it will, because everybody out there is going to watch it.
Everyone's watching Fox Nation. It's America's most exciting new series.
Yeah.
New streaming service, I should say. And they also have wrestling, which is also great.
Yeah.
Here's more. Let's go to 57. This is David anointing a future king.
And mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
All right, little drama.
Oh yeah, no, there's all kind. I mean, this is what, you know, going back to your question, why did I choose to do this? I mean, I grew up in a Christian home. I read my Bible and all these incredible stories of various characters throughout Scripture.
Did you go to Catholic school?
No, we were more like a non-denominational Christian. My mom grew up Catholic, so my grandma used to drag me and my sisters to Mass every once in a while. Non-denominational Christian home, but reading the Bible, Old and New Testament. And to me, the story of David is kind of the most epic. I mean, you know, obviously within Christianity, the story of Jesus is the top of the mountain. But what's interesting is that with Christ, it's difficult to relate to Jesus because he was Jesus. But David is flawed like we are. David was a man after God's own heart, and he was a good man who meant to do good in the world and did do good in the world, but also failed miserably multiple times, was a murderer, an adulterer. I mean, you know, but and still through that, he repented, and God saw that repentance, and he had mercy, and he loved him still. And I think these are things we need to remember and apply to ourselves of, you know, really God's amazing, undying love for us.
Have somebody told you that I'm flawed? Because I really right now want to get lumped in with the rest of humanity. So you're saying you're flawed, but don't drag me down.
No.
I'm
clearly
playing the perfect
you are.
Game. Yeah. I mean, come on, Zach. I mean, what is going on here? We're
paragon
all
paragon of
thank you
of yeah. integrity.
Yes, I haven't made the Bible yet, but yeah. if there's a third book,
I'm
sure I'll be in there somewhere. So, do you find that more people are more comfortable talking about religion these days?
Yeah, I think in some ways, I don't know, man. I personally, I've never felt uncomfortable. Even in Hollywood, I never, you know, I think that the issue that people have had in the past is not so much with someone sharing their personal faith.
Yeah.
It's, are you using that as a cudgel to try and beat someone into believing what you believe? And I think, unfortunately, in all religions, including in Christianity, there has been a lot of history of people doing those types of things, of being like, I'm right, you're wrong, you got to believe what I believe. And that leaves a sour taste in people's mouth. But if you just genuinely just share who you are and what you believe, I think a lot of people have a lot of openness for that. And I do think there is absolutely a spiritual renaissance of sorts that's going on right now, because people are seeing the brokenness in this world, young men and women who are, you know, addicted, even adults like us that are on our phones, that are distracted with all that's going on, and all of the hurt that's going on in the world, and lack of purpose. And so people are turning to God again in really cool ways.
Zachary Levi's here. His brand new series is out 1 week at a time. It's not all at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. Every Thursday for the next four Thursdays, I guess.
So the other thing I noticed too is Kevin James has a new movie out. And I watched everyone asking him, you like Trump? You don't like Trump? He's like, I'm not political. Don't want to talk about it. Yeah. Adam Sandler, same thing. I'm not political. I don't want to talk about it. Then you have Robert De Niro crying that Donald Trump, literally crying that Donald Trump is president. And then Mark Ruffalo, another great actor, was part of a rally against it. Do you notice that, what is the best plan to be successful in Hollywood, where people judge you on your skills? Just to say, stay ambivalent?
Oh, man, I mean, I don't know that I'm really the one to ask, because I came out very strongly in this last election, really for the first time, because I just felt like this was kind of a do or die moment for our country and for the world. I said it many times. I think that Trump is full of his own flaws, and a lot of the bullishness or the brashness or the things that people who did vote for him, including myself, I sit there and I go, why? Like, why do you have to do that? That's not necessary. Yeah. And also, based on what I've heard from a lot of people that spend actual time with him, he's a really decent human being, right? So it's very contrary if that's
the case. Would you like the big picture in his plan for the
country? Listen, and that, and Bobby Kennedy and Tulsi Gabbard and J.D. Vance and Elon Musk and that whole kind of super team that was being brought together, if I'm looking at voting for the other option or that team, that's the team. I'm going with them, because the other option to me was a bad idea any way you sliced it.
And the political correctness was killing your business anyway.
Yeah. So I was one of the people I probably could have, maybe should have not said anything. But to me, I feel like we got to go to commercial.
David King of Israel, check out his series every Thursday. Zachary Levi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade back in Midtown Manhattan after spending 3 days in D.C. and then doing Laura Ingraham's show last night. It was a lot of fun. So interesting to see people in action and go over to the White House and see that machine in action. And they are ebullient about the president's performance. I would have to say, I had a chance to see the president yesterday. I have to say, I've never, ever seen him happier. I'm not saying I see him every day, so I didn't see him after the election wins. But I watched him, and he seemed measured and pleased. But yesterday, in my opinion, I've never seen him happier. And he's gotten calls from really important people that don't work for him, who said, best speech ever, and it was really well produced. I talked to Karl Rove yesterday, too, who was very... calls balls and strikes. He feels the same way. I'm going to find out from Josh Krashauer, another political expert, in a moment about that. We'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There's a genuine level of support there and respect. And it's a shame that sort of this storyline and narrative is kind of blown up and overshadowing kind of that connection, genuine interest in one another and cheering one another on.
Hillary Knight, captain of the women's gold medal winning hockey team. USA's gold medal win continues to generate a degree of controversy, not with me, but with others, as the equally amazing women, a team, wait for their day in the sun after they got their gold dramatically against Canada, and how they're handling the president's joke after the men's win.
Number two.
The negotiations tomorrow and the talks tomorrow will be largely focused on the nuclear program. And we hope progress can be made, because that's the president's preference, to make progress on the diplomatic front.
That is true, Mr. Secretary. All eyes on Geneva as we see if Iran can throw themselves onto the mercy of the American delegation. They're in a break now until the evening. I'm not sure what they proposed this morning. We don't know that yet. Maybe I'll find out shortly.
Number one.
The president said this last night. We inherited a mess. Our ask to the American people is let us continue to fix this mess, make your life better. That's what the president is prioritizing, and that's what we're going to keep doing.
Vice President of the United States with America's Newsroom yesterday, talking the State of the Union and taking that act and agenda on the road. Trump and Vance fan out. It looks like Vance is in Wisconsin. Trump will be in Texas tomorrow. The big question, how about this? What's the Democrats' plan, any plan, that we could analyze to see who has a better vision for making the economy roar to the best of its ability? Josh Krasshauer joins us now. Josh, do you think Republicans can effectively make the Democrats play their hand and talk about what they would do? I mean, if you ask me, it's more green energy and more and raise taxes.
Well, one of the most effective things that President Trump did in the State of the Union address, Brian, is draw that contrast with the Democratic Party. He relished kind of the moments where he was bringing up what I would call 80-20 issues on anything from immigration enforcement to trans activism to, you know, just kind of the, you know, the economic plan that he's pushed through. But the getting them to sit down and not celebrate these general issues that most Americans across party lines support, what was, I think, a political success. That said, as you note, Brian, the economy is the number one issue for voters. He's got to make the case. He started to do that with the State of the Union, but he's got to make the case that his economic plan, the big, beautiful bill, the tax cuts are actually going to really percolate down to average Americans. They're going to start feeling the economic macroeconomic strength that we see in a lot of the indicators. So, I mean, I think, yes, the political success of the State of the Union is now passed. I think that the goal going forward, starting with his campaign trip, by the way, but his visit to Texas to really underscore a lot of the points he made in the State of the Union, is make the case on the economy, tell Americans what to expect on the economy and why it's doing better than a lot of people think.
So this is some of the fallout. I thought this was interesting from CNN, Howard Enten, on some of the way they acted, some of the demonstrations. 73 did not show up. They had dancing, I think dancing rats or dancing frogs, excuse me. I mean, some of the stuff that he had, singing anchors. What was going on with this? Here's Harry Enten, Cut 13.
This is just a downright clown car at this point on the Democratic side. I mean, just take a look here. Top choices for the 2028 Dempres nominee. You have a leader, but it's not really a clear leader. It's within the margin of error. You have Newsom at 19%. Then you have former Vice President Kamala Harris at 18%. Quite a weak number for her, given that, of course, she was the nominee last time around. Pete Buttigieg, who, of course, has run before, 13%. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at 12%. This is just a total clown car. It is a total mess. There is no clear front runner at this particular point on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know where anyone's emerged that got people excited. How do you feel?
Well, yeah, the fact that you had how many different State of the Union responses from different Democrats tells you a lot about the ideological divisions within the party. The fact that Kamala Harris is still kind of hanging around there, even though I don't think anyone wants her to run for president, tells you a whole lot. I actually think Gavin Newsom is the odds-on favorite right now, or early on in the cycle. I think he's gotten the media attention. He's captured a lot of the kind of political classes on the Democratic side's attention. He's certainly, and look, media attention is not easy to come by these days. It's either you go so far left, like AOC does in the Democratic Party, to get viral attention from the far left, or you have to, you know, just do it the hard way and just get earned media day by day. Newsom has, I will say, over the last year, has been able to get that attention, get coverage. So I do think he is emerging as an early front runner for the Democratic nomination, though it's obviously a lot of time to go.
But the comments that he made in Atlanta with the mayor, "I'm stupid like you, I can't read like you." Listen to Cornel West in as he tries to blame Sean Hannity for it or Fox. Listen to this.
"I thought he was going in a humanistic direction. I thought he was going to say, I'm just like you. I was born of a woman. I'm just like you. I'm going to die just like you. I'm just like you. I got to deal with the death of loved ones." But no, he didn't go in that humanistic direction. When he thinks of black people, he thinks of lower SAT. Now, see, we see that in the Trump administration, too.
Yep.
That's what DEI and the vicious attack on DEI was. It's the low SAT. That's one of the core pillars of white supremacy. We are less beautiful, we're less moral, and we're less intelligent. Don't play with us like that.
So, good luck. Go marginalize him as a right winger.
Though that's quite a quote there, Brian. There are a lot of weaknesses that Gavin Newsom has, being his California record, I think, is first and foremost. But also a big weakness for Gavin Newsom is the fact that he is an elitist. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. The famous French, breaking the COVID laws that he imposed to go to a fancy dinner at French Laundry. I mean, that is something he's well aware of. To break through in the Democratic Party, he doesn't have the appeal with your average voter, and that's a real challenge. I think he's been using that 960 SAT line for a while now. He's actually been dropping that to try to make him seem less elite. I don't think it's effective at all. I don't think people like talking about your SAT scores. Usually isn't a way to win voters and win support. But it shows that the Democratic Party has become a very elite party. It's a problem they've been trying to crack. A lot of the candidates that might have a little more working class appeal, like a Josh Shapiro or Bashir in Kentucky, aren't really breaking through. And Newsom is, if he is the one of the early front runners, he's got a real vulnerability in appealing to the average voter. And I think that's going to show as he gets more media attention.
You wrote about Gen Z, and the growing support for candidates linked to anti-Semitism is raising alarms. And case in point, it's that crazy Graham Plantner, an anti-establishment oyster farmer who had basically a Nazi symbol on his chest. He took it off or blurred it out. That's helping him with a double-digit lead over the current sitting governor?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of an amazing story that may not get enough attention. The governor of Maine, Democrat, is running for the Senate. She's been elected two times, a known commodity in Maine, and she's losing by 40 to 50 points in a primary against oyster farmer who has had a neo-Nazi tattoo for decades, right? Who has engaged in Israel bashing, who has catered to the farthest left elements of the Democratic Party. And that is where the energy of the Democratic Party is right now. That is why people like AOC and Newsom are leading the early polling of the Democratic field. And a guy like Josh Shapiro, who has won with significant margins in Pennsylvania and is winning over independents and even some Republicans, he's overlooked. He's barely registering in these Democratic presidential primary polls. The energy of the party is well to the left. These anti-establishment far left candidates are gaining steam. It's not just Plattner. It's in Minnesota. There's a primary where a moderate congresswoman is losing to a far left lieutenant governor. We obviously talked about Mamdani a lot in New York City. You're seeing this very radical energy that's percolating in the Democratic Party. And look, it may feel good at the moment, but it's going to make a lot of these candidates less electable. I mean, it's going to make the party brand very tarnished if these are the figures of the party coming 2028.
Well, I think it's I just don't know where it came from. I don't understand it. I don't understand where. Forget about the anti-Semitism is just an evil belief. But what about the anti-Israel feeling? I mean, I wouldn't say everyone who's anti-Israel is anti-Semitic. Maybe you would. I don't. Some people don't like Israel's policy or Netanyahu. I actually think he's doing an unbelievable job. You investigate what happened. I got it on January 8th. Do your investigation. But for the most part, I think they're our best friends in the world. But where did this anti-Israel thing come from?
Well, the anti-Israel, I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons for it. I mean, part of it is that the farthest left elements of the party have always been you know, have always hated Israel, and now they're being accommodated within the party, whereas, you know, not that long ago, they were shunned. There was just another episode in San Francisco yesterday where the mayor, Democratic mayor of San Francisco, was unveiling an economic plan, and the socialists, there were members of the socialist wing of the Democratic Party, the DSA, in California that were screaming, tax the Jews. That's blatant anti-Semitism, and the very incendiary rhetoric against Israel all too often evolves or mutates into out-and-out anti-Semitism. And the problem the Democratic Party has faced is, instead of saying, this is a red line, we don't want you in the party, we don't want the extremists in the party, they're like, yeah, we want to have a Big Tent coalition, it's okay. We're a party that has socialists and moderates. And when you don't set any boundaries or any moral lines, you're going to have political problems. In the short term, it might feel good to have a candidate who's getting youthful energy, but then you realize he has a Nazi tattoo and has a whole lot of radical beliefs. And he becomes the face of the party, and it's going to make the party a lot less electable in the big picture.
Bernie Sanders loves him.
Yeah, he's been endorsed by not just Bernie Sanders, but endorsed by a lot of other progressive elected officials in the country. And Democrats look at, there's a generational element, Brian, and that's what alarms both Democrats and Republicans, frankly, that the 18 to 34 year old cohort is the most supportive of some of the most radical elements. And it's not just about, you know, Middle East politics or anti-Semitism. There's a scary tolerance for political violence among the youngest cohorts in the country. There's a rejection of capitalism and the support for socialism among the most youthful elements of the country. I think it has a lot to do with our education system. But the candidates are responding to those cues, that there is this demand on the far left and among younger voters for a radical brand of politics.
So I want you to hear J.D. Vance. I think there's elements within the administration that are pushing back against our possible attack on Iran with Israel. Here's J.D. Vance. Might be one of those people. Cut 20.
Does that mean the supreme leader has to go?
Well, again, I think the president ultimately will make the decision about how to ensure Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. But we're sitting down having another round of diplomatic talks with the Iranians, trying to reach a reasonable settlement. But a reasonable settlement towards what end? Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. It's very simple, Bill. I think the supreme leader and everybody in their system should understand it. We've been crystal clear, and we're hopeful that we're able to come to a good resolution without the military. But if we have to use the military, the president, of course, has that right as well.
So there is leaks coming out of, you know, the Situation Room, where, you know, the other talks and detailed talks about the military. We see it pop up in the New York Times. Josh, what are your sources saying is going on?
Well, look, when I hear that type of rhetoric from Vice President Vance, who has been, you know, at least internally, a little more reticent for military action against Iran, when he's really talking tough like that, I mean, it suggests to me that Trump is very strongly leaning towards some sort of military action in the coming weeks, and probably sooner than later. That is notable. That I thought that was actually one of the more newsy developments this week, hearing that from the Vice President on Fox. So, yeah, I mean, look, I mean, you listen to the State of the Union. Trump didn't talk a whole lot about Iran, but he certainly laid some pretty red lines, pretty strong red lines. There are negotiations that are taking place right now in Geneva. But everyone I've talked to are very skeptical that the Iranians are going to make any real concessions to really take out, to dismantle their nuclear facilities, to get rid of their ballistic missiles, which are the key sticking points from the U.S. point of view. So, I think we are more than not likely headed to some kind of military action against Iran, and Trump has been signaling that more and more in the recent days.
And I think if you team up with Israel and you can get them the refueling capacity that they didn't have in the 12-day war, and with their intelligence on the ground and execution and motivation, I think it'll be the one thing to slay an enemy that we've had for 47 years. And that's what I'm going to talk about at One Nation this weekend. People should realize this is not a today thing. It's not a Donald Trump thing. But he does believe he could end this. And I think he sees an opportunity for the country. And he doesn't see somebody else coming up behind him or her, that will feel the same way. Also, this is a time when they still haven't rebuilt their missile defense.
Yeah.
And their economy's in tatters. And right now, their currency is worthless. So, any final thought, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is Iran at its most vulnerable vulnerable point, I would also caution, and this is what Trump is also hearing, that you know, this would not be a pinprick strike, and you know, there's no such thing as just doing one strike against Iran and hoping things are over and done with. This is the prospect of a lengthy, extended military operation that could lead, at least some of the options being discussed, are regime change. So, I mean, I think the risks and the lengthy, this would occupy, I think, a decent part of 2026 if Trump does go ahead through it. So I think that is the big question. Is this going to be a big if he does go ahead with an Iran strike, it would be a major part of his legacy. High reward, getting rid of one of the worst actors in the world would be a huge accomplishment, but there are a lot of sticky points that could come about as
true.
A result.
I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but that's why seven other presidents couldn't do it. If it was easy, Reagan or Obama or Clinton, somebody would have done it. Bush, somebody would have slayed that dragon.
Yep.
But we are where we are, and it's going to be another major decision for the president, which I know the American people want to focus on the economy, but sometimes the world doesn't cooperate. Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, I went a little long on that. I apologize, but I'm going to do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. But when we come back, 1-866-408-7669. I already got enough emails for an entire segment, so I'll go through some of that over the last few days. State of the Union, your thoughts. Also, the thought about Iran. You know, the only 27% of the country say we should be attacking Iran. It has a lot to do with the fact if the president hasn't sat down and over a series of interviews and speeches said, this is what I'm dealing with. These are the choices we have to make. And this is why the timing might be right. We know this, that the Iranians prior to going into this meeting came out and said, we will retain the right to have nuclear energy. Not good. And number one, what the American side said is, there will be no sunset provision. Whatever we come with.
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I stay in regular touch with my police commissioner, and I appreciate the work that she's doing. You know, I've said time and time again that I, having seen these videos, to me it was a snowball fight that got out of hand, and it should be treated accordingly. So, I've said again and again of what I think it was.
I am so outraged by the reaction of this terrible mayor in New York City. If you've seen the video, you know what I'm talking about. You see these cops show up because a social media scheduled snowball fight in the middle of a 30 inches in New York City that people throw up to have a snowball fight. Adults, you know, 18 to 25. So they're not kids. They're adults. And it's starting to get out of control. The cops get called. So about 10 show up. And they start getting pelted. These are like assaults. So can you imagine getting a water bottle and just whipping it at a cop? You would never do that. You go, that's an assault. So what does this mayor not understand about this happening and the humiliation? Obviously, these men and maybe some women, I didn't see any women, feel, two of which went to the hospital. You're getting objects thrown at you because a snowball fight is considered something kids do and might be portrayed in a fun way on television and in movies. If you watch that, you know that is not fun. And this is not a snowball fight the cops started. They were called in to bring an end to the anarchy. And they were called in to do something about it. And when they did something about it, when they showed up, they were targeted. Here's another cut. Mondami again being questioned about this.
What I saw yesterday in these videos was a snowball fight that got out of hand. I believe that our officers, just like any city workers, deserve respect. And, you know, once again, I think these are the views that I've shared both kind of in public as well as in any conversations I've had.
Okay. At one point, with the man with the perpetual smile and the hatred of billionaires who wants to spend $70 million on his supermarkets, I'm out of money. I have to raise property taxes, but I need $70 million for supermarkets that I can run. He doesn't understand that his police commissioner says this is an assault. I'm charged. Here are four faces. When I see them, they're going to be arrested. The mayor keeps saying no arrest. The same mayor that hears about a deranged idiot in Staten Island who comes after cops with a knife, goes to jail when he gets shot, goes to the hospital after he gets shot and gets visited by the mayor. He actually visited the attacker. That's how twisted this idiot is. So here is former NYPD Chief of Detectives Robert Boyce, said the mayor is jeopardizing his relationship with the department. Not to back up the men and women is really, really bad. It's as bad as you can get. So this is a seminal moment right here. And we'll see how it goes from here, because I think it's important to understand just how important this is to the police department. Look, you might not be listening to my show. You might not be watching Fox. But how many more people who work with you that you need are going to have to explain to you that this is not a snowball fight? This is the same thing. I don't know if you guys remember a few years ago, the cops in the summer, they were just pouring water on their heads and throwing them water, and this is how it looked. And then all hell breaks loose. That's why when they go on the street, now they got to wrestle with people. Instead of people fearing cops, they try to fight cops, because they know under this mayor, and whatever you want to say about Eric Adams, he would not have tolerated this. He certainly would have had their back. Lastly, here's the one other cut. Cut 38.
I'm not going to be banning snowball fights or organized snowball fights. I've shared my thoughts with New Yorkers, and I continue to believe that what we are seeing in this response, this winter blizzard, from the city workers as a whole, and that includes the hardworking men and women of the NYPD, is part of why the city's getting back on its feet, and I'm appreciative of that work.
I don't know what to say. Your own police commissioner, who never should have stayed on. It's good for me. It makes up the city safer. But she's not going to last a year, Jessica Tisch. I mean, she's the one who came in and straightened out a very corrupt department and got some power and was able to have some leverage over the mayor, who thought he was police commissioner too. So and then she decides to stay, and that was probably one of the most positive things that could happen. So she decides to stay. If she decides to leave, and she decides to leave quickly, it's going to show you how bad this guy is. Do you know what he also did yesterday? So he says, I'm going to raise property taxes. I have no other choice. He's got like a huge hole in the budget, he claims. But he's also asking for $127 million to run a city. Do you know that Mike Bloomberg ran the city on 80? So what is this guy spending it on? Now, he inherited a lot of this, but his programs all talk about spending. He can find the money when he has to. And this is emblematic of something bigger. Another socialist ascends to a position that doesn't require politics, requires competence. And all you have is somebody who doesn't want to do the job. They want to have the ceremonial part of the job. Some of your emails have come in. I voted for Trump 3 times. I contributed to 2024 reelection after observing his treatment of the people of Ukraine and our allies in general. I can't trust the president again. I support many of his policy moves and will testify to that, but I'm not going to sugarcoat or ignore his terrible treatment of the people of Ukraine. I will say this. I don't think it's the treatment of Ukraine. He is selling the weapons to NATO. We don't have that much more weapons yet. I am the most foremost pro-Ukraine person, certainly in this building and maybe in the country, but he has not abandoned Ukraine. He's trying to get everybody to the table. I think at one point he's going to realize that it's not really Zelensky is not stopping the peace situation, but he also knows if he comes out like Joe Biden and Senator Lindsey Graham and says Zelensky's the best, he doesn't get Putin to the table. So there's a little bit of strategy here, but the president's going to realize, keep in mind what he's doing. He's already told India, don't buy oil. That's what Biden should have done. He looked the other way. He's come down with additional sanctions. He's harassed Europe to stop with buying natural gas. And now we've picked up the pace on exporting natural gas and constructed terminals. As you had Lavrov, the foreign minister, come out and say, you know, we're tired of America acting different than they say. We're tired of listening to America and to Donald Trump. We're seeing his actions. And we think that it's going back to the days of Joe Biden. That's pretty much a compliment. But I understand your frustration to a degree. How about this from John? John says Peter Schweitzer has been sounding the alarm that Mexico and China are directing immigrants from those countries to the U.S. to infiltrate but not integrate into the American culture. I think that was happening. I think it is to a degree, but I think there's a massive crackdown. I would hope to lessen the number of to lessen the number of Chinese students in our country because they leave their families at home. And even if they love the culture and love their college, they will be told, you get us this information or your family will be in jeopardy. So Linda writes this, and we were talking about this, about the teeth of Jack, of the hockey player. And Jack was, last night he was skating again for the New Jersey Devils, and he was honored there, and it was great, and it was a lot of fun. But his teeth got knocked out, and he said, I think people would be disappointed if I got my teeth fixed. While we're talking on the show, I found out, the thing is, if your tooth actually comes out of your mouth and doesn't get broken, if your tooth comes out of your mouth, then you can put it back in right away and your gum will take it back. And everyone said I was crazy. Well, Jack Hughes said last night that he is going to leave his teeth broken because people seem to want it. So here's a little of his speech, and then I'll tell you what you guys just wrote me showing that I'm right. Here's Jack Hughes. Cut 27.
I'm so proud and I'm so happy that the men's and women's USA hockey teams brought gold medals back to the United States of America. You guys are making me emotional, but I'm so proud to represent the New Jersey Devils organization. And I'm so, so proud to represent the great state of New Jersey. So proud. From the bottom of my heart, all my teammates, USA teammates, we just want to thank you guys for all the love and the support. We feel it. Thank you.
So here's a little bit later after the game, they said, are you going to fix your teeth? And he said, I think people would be mad at me if I did. So I brought up, if they came out clean, you could have popped it back in. And he did pick up his teeth after they got knocked out in the game. So this is what Linda writes, because I know I'm right, by the way. Having practiced dentistry for many years, it's always been a hoot when non-dentists talk about teeth. But Brian, you're pretty much on the mark about reimplanting an avulsed. They call it a avulsed tooth. Now you have a new term to use. Have a great day. Linda, thank you so much. But I found out, you know how I found out? Are you guys curious? Pete and Eric?
Sure.
Okay. Beth Stern, the wife of Howard Stern, I was interviewing her for the book, The Games Do Count. It's How You Play the Game. And she was saying that she was one of her indelible moments. She was playing basketball and she took an elbow and her tooth got knocked out and it's sitting there on the ground. And her father, who's a dentist, came out, cleaned it and put it right back in her mouth and she continued playing. So I was astounded by that. But it was one of those stories that always stuck with me. So when this happened again, I was able to use my library of knowledge from my years of talking to other people. And I think I helped America. Anybody want to second that motion? Nobody. Thought I could win you guys over. But I am right. Even Carly Shimkus told me I am right. She just emailed me before.
The Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, I'm not exactly ready to join Stuart Varney. He's still got a couple of guests on, but it's kind of interesting. Stuart had an interview with a couple of these guys before they were, a couple of these New Jersey guys, before they were Olympians. So I think he's going to be going to talk a little hockey to get started. But he actually interviewed Jack Hughes when he was first round draft pick. Let's listen
in. Kilmeade time. All right, Brian, the men's hockey team getting some backlash after their call with President Trump. I spoke to Dave Portnoy about it, and here's what he had to say.
Well, anybody who has a problem with anything the men did should be checked into a mental institution. They're absolute psychopaths. I have no problem. People want to say, hey, maybe Donald Trump shouldn't have made that joke in the moment. You hated Trump before that joke. You hate him now. Fine, you hate him. But to try to throw this on the men's hockey team, who just had the greatest moments of their life. It's 5 minutes after the game ended. And you want them to be like, oh, hold on, Mr. President. You can't make that joke right now in the locker room. We need a minute. You can't do that. It is so stupid.
Okay, tell us how you really feel. Look, Brian, you met some of the players.
Did the men's team do anything wrong, in your opinion?
Absolutely zero. I mean, in the past, you might say, well, it wasn't good to go to a club and drink at a bar. Now they're saying, why didn't you just go to a club and drink at a bar? They did that, too. So they, the President of the United States says, come see me. They said, sounds great. I think a lot of them like the president anyway. But if Joe Biden called, it would have been no problem. They would have went and saw him in 2 seconds. And they, if invited, they probably wouldn't have thought of it. That's, they weren't that creative in their communication. Remember what we were dealing with over there, the worst press secretary ever. We know that Jen Psaki was fine, so her successor wasn't. So they had no imagination at all, and they had a president that was a no-show. But this president is all over sports. The guy's the first one ever to go to the Super Bowl. He's going to be at more World Cup games than Stuart Varney and Stuart Varney's family. So he is everywhere. He's going to go to a Yankee. He went to a Yankee game. So listen, he'll go everywhere. Calling to the locker room is something he did. Remember, I was overseas in Germany, and he said, let me call in and talk to the troops. I mean, what is that? It's not Republican or Democrat. He wants to talk to troops. He wants to talk to athletes. And then he honestly picked out the guy that had one of the best single performances in Connor Hellenbeck in the history of sports. Every time some people talk about great performances in big games, they will talk about him. He gave him an award. So it was great. So if there's backlash, like I saw this Canadian newspaper, they said it was a zoo and the players became monkeys. That's called you lost in a game you invented. It must be humiliating. They are allowed to celebrate. You defeated them 6 months earlier in a different tournament. I didn't see anybody complaining. I'm watching the Canadian coach say, we should not have overtime when it's 3-on-3 and give in to television. No, that's an exciting way. You and I have a complaint. Soccer ends in penalty kicks. I would love to see 9-on-9 instead of 11-on-11 or 7-on-7. Anything except penalty kicks. So I thought to NHL, I thought hockey should be saluted by the tournament and the players for their how amiable they were.
I've got to get this in, Brian, because I know you feel strongly. Mazaran Mandami, he's doubling down on his snowball fight narrative. Watch this.
I've said that what I saw was a snowball fight. It should be treated accordingly. It was one that got out of hand, but that's what it was.
You willing to revise your statement regarding the snowball fight, given that this was not exactly a friendly back-and-forth snowball fight?
I'm not going to be banning snowball fights or organized snowball fights. I've said time and time again that I, having seen these videos, to me it was a snowball fight that got out of hand, and it should be treated accordingly. So, I've said again and again of what I think it was.
We should tell everyone that the NYPD arrested a 27-year-old male suspect for the alleged assault. He was arrested for an attempted robbery less than 3 weeks ago. The video is self-explanatory. These cops were attacked, Brian. Simple as that.
And the NYPD, this former chief of detectives, Robert Boyce, says that the mayor is jeopardizing the relationship with his department. He could lose the whole department if he doesn't amend his statements. And this is what I want people to say. Snowball fights, it sounds juvenile. Understand that this is an assault. If I told you cops showed up and they were hit with water bottles, you'd say, of course it's an assault. This time they show up and they get hit with snowballs and ice balls. And they were relentless. And the cops were basically helpless. Two went to the hospital. And they were humiliated by doing this. And they came down to create some semblance of order because their snowball fight got out of control. So if you're a cop, you watch that and you feel that humiliation. Sure. Retired and active, this is sinful. And this guy does not have the sensibility to understand you misspoke.
This city's in trouble 2 months into his administration. Yep. Brian, thanks a lot. See you again soon. Still ahead.
Hey, let's go out to John in Jacksonville. Hey, John.
Hey, Brian, I'm not a dentist, but I played one on TV. All seriousness, I am a physician, and you should ask Linda Stern if her tooth survived.
Beth Stern.
Because, yeah, it's easy to put it back in as a child, and they often will, stay in and become healthy, but a lot of the adult tooth won't survive. By the way, I'm a huge Jack Hughes fan.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the whole country is now. Do you think the players hurt themselves at all by what they did?
Not at all. I mean, come on. Can we have a sense of unseriousness and making everything political these days, Brian?
Yeah, all right. Let's go out to Tony in Montreal. Maybe he feels differently. Tony.
How you doing, Brian?
So how do you feel about the way the players handled their victory?
Listen, I was an NCAA player. I played in Maine. I played against Tortorella and great players like that. John is an NHL caliber coach. Hockey players are known to be non-compos mentis. When we win, we drink, we have parties, we go crazy, we go to the fraternities, we turn things upside down. I'm a Canadian boy, but I have a lot of friends in the States. I have family in Tucson, Arizona. I have family all over the United States. I congratulate the Americans for winning the gold medal, because if anybody's going to win the gold medal other than us, we would not like to see China win the gold medal or some other country that is hateful towards the United States or Canada. Listen, friendly competition
is good.
Between Muhammad Ali and Frazier, everyone thought they hated each other, but Muhammad Ali paid for Frazier's...
Good point, Tony. And next time they play each other in any tournament, World Championships, we'll all be watching. Thanks so much. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. Back in New York. Happy to be here. Big hour coming your way. And, of course, a lot on the docket. We look at we have a lot happening in New York where we have a snowball controversy. I'm not kidding. And it matters. A lot at stake. And we're trying to get out of the snow problem that we're a little having. 31 inches, bit of a problem. I think my family sent me a message because they had to deal with all this snow while I was in D.C. First, they had to come in Sunday because I couldn't get snowed in and miss work. And then I went to D.C. for 3 days. And when I went to start up my car, I go, great. And the problem was it was still covered in snow. So at 3 a.m, I was cleaning off my car. And something tells me I shouldn't complain. Big three.
Number three.
There's a genuine level of support there and respect, and it's a shame that sort of this storyline and narrative is kind of blown up and overshadowing kind of that connection and genuine interest in one another and cheering one another on.
Yep, women's hockey captain Hillary Knight. USA's hockey gold was win continues to generate a lot of publicity and a degree of controversy. We'll discuss it.
Number two.
The negotiations tomorrow and the talks tomorrow will be largely focused on the nuclear program. And we hope progress can be made, because that's the president's preference, to make progress on the diplomatic front.
By the way, tomorrow's today. And that is Marco Rubio, all eyes on Geneva. The morning session, enough to have an afternoon session. And it should be underway right now in Geneva. We'll see what happens. Why I think this whole thing falls apart and we are going to attack.
Number one.
The president said this last night. We inherited a mess. Our ask to the American people is let us continue to fix this mess, make your life better. That's what the president is prioritizing, and that's what we're going to keep doing.
That is the Vice President of the United States talking, taking the State of the Union on the road. The agenda goes to Wisconsin with the Vice President and Texas Friday with the President. It's going to be a regular thing now as they tout their economic gains, their plans, and how they want to turn around the numbers. I also hope they do some listening and find out what the frustration is so it's not told to a pollster, but it's told to them directly. But the big story is going to be shortly something the President, I hope, talks about solely. And that is, he gave about 7 minutes to it on the State of the Union, but Iran, why now is the right time? The Gang of Eight's been briefed. They know it's serious. They also know that Iran has been a major problem to Jimmy Carter, to Ronald Reagan, to Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, the Iran-Contra issue, the hostages taken, the Khobar Towers, the 83 Marine bombing, one of the lowest points of the Reagan years. The problems we've had with their Navy during the Reagan years, and then the JCPOA, the disaster with Barack Obama that reinvigorated their economy, didn't allow inspectors to see their nuclear program, and then Donald Trump, killing of Soleimani, the threatening to assassinate Donald Trump, John Bolton. You understand that they have it coming to them, especially after the 12-day war. Is this the right time, and what are the risks? There are plenty. Vice Admiral Robert Horwood joins us now, member of the Iran Policy Project at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. Thanks so much for joining us, Admiral. What do you expect to happen on the afternoon session over in Geneva?
Well, first off, it's very clear the regime has one objective, survive Donald Trump. as you went through, you just gave this litany of our background there. Obama came in and wanted the JCPOA so bad, he gave him $1.7 billion in cash, which, of course, immediately went out to their surrogates, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, to build their networks. And then under the Biden administration, they unfroze $16 billion. Those two events were counterproductive to the stream we've on. And you've outlined very clearly how much they've done it against us. And you forgot to mention they were killing our troops in Iraq.
600 plus.
So this thing's got a long litany, and they're going to play every game in the world that they've been playing for just to play this out and try to survive Donald Trump. I think that's going to become very clear today in the negotiations. They're not going to agree to destroy their three nuclear sites. They're not going to deliver all the enriched uranium. They're not going to agree to zero enrichment. They're not going to agree to minimal sanctions where we prove all this out. And then, you know, they're going to have to close their new facilities in Pixax and Isfahan. So they're not to agree to all that. And that will play out here in the next few days, setting the stage for Trump to respond.
And I should point out to our audience, you grew up in Iran, pre-revolution. And so you have a real sense of what it could be like. They're a well-educated society, very sophisticated. And it seems to me, from what I hear and what I read and what I see, that about 90% of the country hates their government. Do you think that's accurate?
Yes, I do, without a doubt. I hear it from all my Iranian friends in the country. I hear it from Iranians I run into. They're fed up. This government has failed them, and they're murdering them. So it's going to happen. It's interesting when you think of the president. You know, this is probably his greatest political risk, but it's also his most principled action yet. He's made a commitment to the Iranian people. Help is on the way. We will not tolerate killing you. I believe if he doesn't get what he wants out of these negotiations in very near order, we're going to see this thing come to fruition. And a lot of Iranian people are counting on that. So I do believe it's going to evolve back to the Iranian it was in the 60s and 70s, where a lot of hardworking people, well-educated, will demand a government who represents and takes care of them. And so the sheer capacity is what's different now.
Admiral, what do you say to people who keep insisting, and a lot of it's on the right, that Israel is pushing us into this?
Well, sure, it's in Israel's interest as well, but it's in the interest of the whole region and the world. This changes the geopolitical situation. Don't forget, Iran didn't just hit Israel. It hit Saudi. It hit UAE. And part of the agenda here in the strikes is to ensure we remove all those offensive missiles and maritime assets that threaten those allies. So I think this plays out very well for the region to become prosperous, peaceful, and stable that is not seen for decades. So it's much bigger than Israel. But, of course, they have a big stake. This is an existential threat to them.
So are you happy? I mean, I looked at the numbers. It's short of what we built up for Iraq because we wanted to have an invasion and we had hundreds of thousands of troops in Kuwait and staged elsewhere to go in. But are you happy with what you see right now with two aircraft carriers, 40,000 in the region, the F-16s, the F-35s, the F-22s? Do you think we have enough to make Vice Admiral Robert Howard optimistic we can have a sustained attack?
Well, again, the attack, first off, has to be to mitigate, take out their elements of power, the projection. So, yes, I do believe we have that. We have the ability to see. And now with a minimal threat to our aircraft, we're able to watch, provide eyes on and watch those targets. So when missile launchers are used, they'll be gone shortly thereafter. So I think this is a much different situation. We've had this much force in the region before, but we've never had the positioning and the neutering of Iran like we had previously. Surface-to-air missiles were always a threat, and the last bombing campaign took out a lot of that. So I think this is a much different situation. And I do think we have the ability to make our allies and the region safe. So, yes, I believe we're in place to do that.
So do you believe the drone technology, what we've seen evolve in real time over the last 4 years in Ukraine, could you swarm either either aircraft carrier and create some problems with these drones?
Again, I think range duration is going to be a problem. We know where they are at, so I don't see that being a threat. And those carriers are going to be located where they're hard to target, out of range, and with a lot of air defense. So I'm satisfied they're protected and ready to go. I think more important, Brian, and the big unknown, I haven't been able to get answers to the dynamics on the ground. Who have we been communicating? Have we talked to the Artish, the regular armed force? And unlike Iraq, hey, guys, you could stay in place. We need you to flip and turn on the IRGC, the real guys who are the thugs, the murderers, the mafia. So I don't know. I don't have a sense what's going on the ground. And I think that's a critical component because we're going to have the Iranian people be a part of this as they're prepared to do. But have we set the conditions for them to act in synchronization with our strike?
So looking at the country itself, so we want to I'm wondering if the next leader of Iran's in prison. And I'm wondering if, you know, any threat has been imprisoned. And I know there was that infamous prison and the Israelis blew the door off. And that's as close as they got. And knowing the Israelis and the Mossad and their intelligence, I'm wondering if the next leader could be let out.
Well, it could be. And you're talking about Evin prison. I've been to it several times. It's their infamous.
You have been?
Prison. Yeah, I've been to it. I spent a night there once many, many decades ago, a very strange situation. But it's Evin prison. It's where they keep their political prisoners. Again, they have good intelligence. So very well could be that one of the dissidents who's going to rise up to be a leader could be part of the solution. So I got to believe all that. Networks are being energized, communications in place, coordinations in place, and we're starting to get a sense of what comes after this regime.
Vice Admiral Robert Harwood, our guest, now retired, but he's a member of the Iran policy project at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. So I don't know the makeup. I know, I guess, there's 90 million people in Iran, but they say right now, I was looking at the Institute for Study of War, they said they're planning for a post-Iranian regime reality. A newly established coalition of anti-regime Kurdish organizations outlined a vision for the administration and the Kurdish majority. Well, as we break up into ethnic groups, we got a little PTSD from Iraq. Is there a sense that the ethnic groups will divide or combine if there is a void at the top?
I'm not concerned about either. I think they're going to coordinate. Everybody's going to be enthralled with this opportunity and work together. And each will identify roadmaps or opportunities. But I think that's where U.S. leadership's going to have to step up to the table and be a part of that, of what comes next when that opportunity. And those in Iran already have a sense of what they want and look. So, again, that's part of what I don't have visibility on, but I got to believe and know those conversations are occurring now. But again, I don't think anyone wants to be identified because of the risk inherent until we have a triggering event which flips this thing on its head. So I think all of them, and again, don't forget that this is, we're not talking about tribes here. We're talking about Persian, a culture and countries that's been in existence for 2,500 years, almost 2,600 years. So that sense of unity driven through the Persian history, I think, is what will bind all these entities together at the end of the day.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be like the Venezuelan operation. So there's a worry. The president's got definitely a worry about casualties. People should understand, too, when you brought up Saudi Arabia. Remember, it was about 10 years ago when the Houthis started bombing Saudi Arabia. And then Saudi Arabia put an embargo on, and everyone's saying how cruel they're being. But guess who financed the Houthis, the Iranians, to harass Saudi Arabia?
Well, and you remember Iran shot missiles and drones and took out Saudi oil infrastructure. So they've been attacked both ways, north and south, east and west from Iran. So it gets them directly from Iran.
So, Admiral, why are they pushing back on us taking action? Is that window dressing? Do they really do this with a wink and a nod?
Well, they want to make sure they're not at risk. If Iran knows they're going down the tube, they're going to take as much damage as they can on UAE, Qatar, Saudi. So that's what they're concerned about. They want to make sure they're protected. Do they have enough air defense on their own, or do we have to support? And part of this deployment includes assets which can provide that air support. So again, the initial strikes have to focus on those missiles and the ability to do it. To protect Saudi, to protect UAE. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're talking about. They are not in favor in strikes if it puts them at risk. So we almost have to provide guarantees that we can protect them from these strikes.
Does it bother you that both the UK and France said, you can't use our bases? Starmer Command said, this could be, if you take military action, it's an illegal act. I'm personally offended by that.
Short-sighted.
Yeah,
I think it's short-sighted, and their history indicates just as much the threats that are relevant to them. So again, once this thing starts, let's see how that evolves. Again, anyone has lost sight of what Iran has been, the pariah in the region, murdering people, attacking all its neighbors over the last four decades, it forgets history, and unchecked with the ability to build a nuclear weapon changes that. It'll make them even more aggressive. So I think action is long overdue, and I'm disappointed by the policies of both those countries.
Admiral, if the president says he's got like four or five options, if one of those options is to take out the Ayatollah, what benefit would that be? What's the risk?
Again, at this point, less concern about decapitating the military than decapitating the underlying, the threats and the IRGC. That's right. Those guys are going to go, they're dead. Dead men walking already. So, but you got to take out those elements of power that threaten the region and those elements of power that suppress the people. After that, the Ayatollahs are dead men walking. So I'm not worried about decapitating the leadership. This is decapitating everything below it.
Yeah, they named a whole bunch of people. Everyone had to name four or five successors because they know they're going to be killed, and they know the Israelis are going to come after them. They know where they vacation. They know what they prefer for lunch and dinner. I've been in awe of their intelligence and execution, and I don't think we could have a finer partner in any type of high-risk military operation. And I think you probably agree.
I do. They've been great allies. They face an existential threat. They've been at war all their life, and their capabilities match ours. And working together, as we illustrated on the taking out the nuclear facilities, the air defense is almost overwhelming force.
Great job, Admiral. Thanks so much. You grew up there, and then we could see if this is the end of a regime that could allow you to go back there. Not forever. Just to visit. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We're just trying to focus on celebrating the women in our room, three gold medals in program history, as well as the double gold for both men's and women's at the same time, and really not detract from that with a distasteful joke.
So that is Hillary Knight, captain of the women's team. And what the president said, and I'll just paraphrase, he's talking to the men, he goes, yeah, I want you to come to the White House, and by the way, I'm going to invite the women. You don't want me impeached, do you? It was a joke. But I believe also if the women won second, he'd go, congratulations, thrilling game. But, you know, I got to invite the men if I invite you. It's just one of those things that he does at the podium all the time when he's at these events. And like anybody that's funny, humorous, ad-libbing, sometimes they bomb. And that was taken the wrong way. But he means no offense. As Mark Thiessen pointed out, no one's done more for women's sports than him. He made sure that women actually stayed in women's sports. Can you imagine? I'm not kidding. Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we're going to be greeted by a very important guest. Don't move.
Information.
information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
In some ways, we are pushing a car uphill because the Biden administration left us such a disaster of an economy. The highest peacetime debt in American history, skyrocketing inflation. A lot of Americans who had lost $3,000 was that how much the average American had lost in take-home pay. Now, in a year, we've actually seen the average American gain about $1,200 in take-home pay. But if you're sitting at home from the perspective of the Biden administration, you are still worse off than you were when Joe Biden took over. So we are absolutely pushing that car uphill.
So that is the Vice President of the United States. He's going to bring that message and the message of the State of the Union to Wisconsin. President's going to bring it to Texas. And I think he's going to stay out and about. President knows quite well, and I don't think he minds that he really has to campaign like he's on the ballot. Is that possible? Elizabeth Pipko does know that answer. She's a former GOP national spokesperson, been inside the GOP apparatus. Elizabeth, good to see you.
You too.
So your thoughts about these two going out? I hope it stays continuous. Is that possible for them to continue this?
It's 100% possible. There's no one that we need more on the campaign trail than Donald Trump. I think Susie Wiles, obviously chief of staff of the White House, she said that herself. She said he's going to treat the midterms like we treated that 24 campaign. He needs to be out as often as he can in every single state. Swing states, very important as well, but literally every single state, because Donald Trump knows, even though his name isn't on the ballot, number one, he's incredibly popular. And at the same time, it's his policies that are literally on the ballot. Because if we lose these midterms, Donald Trump is left for 2 years in that office with everyone against him.
Nonstop
investigations, probably worse than we had the first time. He knows what to expect better than anybody. But it means not only will he personally suffer, but the country will suffer. And everything he's done over those 2 years is going to try to be reversed.
You know what I do know? I think what the greatest asset is Democrats' ratings. I mean, I saw the Washington Post poll that had Donald Trump's approval at 39%. Okay, not good. But I also saw a question as who do you trust more in the economy? 33% for Trump, 31% for Dems. I actually don't know anybody who says they're better on the economy. Some want to see better results than President Trump has produced in the last year. You've heard that.
100%. Look, they're banking on the anti-Trump vote. They know that they have absolutely no policies that poll better than the GOP. Right now, they know when it comes to foreign policy, then economy, when it comes to law and order, crime in our cities, things that Democrats and Republicans worry about, the only ones that have any kind of positive approval rating are the Republicans. That's the right. That's all that anyone wants to rely on. They're really, really banking on that far left anti-Trump vote to come
out. So right now, immigration, when you seal the wall so effortlessly, I think he's got to go down there.
Yes.
I think he's got to go to the border pretty consistently and talk about it. I want to see that wall being built. Number two is I think they have to somehow get the immigration issue back. And I think Tom Homan was the first move on that. Well, what do you do to get that back? And people don't worry about how things went awry in Minneapolis, but focus on getting the worst out.
Well, look, Minnesota is its own kind of issue that has really nothing to do with what actually happened on the border. And the fact that we have not had border crossings since Donald Trump came into office, people are not illegally coming in. And under Joe Biden, there were millions coming in. People need to understand that what's going on in Minnesota, what's going on in these states is a separate issue. It's also equally as important. But Donald Trump really did something Joe Biden claimed was impossible to do and which will positively impact our country for years to come. No one talks about it. No one realizes it.
Right. So if you are the Republicans, you're seeing that they're losing a lot of momentum with the Hispanic vote, at least in the polls. So many of them show a decrease. There's a bit of feeling disenchanted by it. You know what the Hispanic community, as diverse as it is, for the most part, why they were coming aboard on the right. How do you get that back?
You need to take back the narrative, right? Donald Trump is the only Republican in recent years who's been able to break through the mainstream narrative that has been historically anti-GOP, right? Anti-Republican. Donald Trump is louder. He is more creative. He's the only person that can swing really a media campaign in one direction or another based on his own words, his own Truth Social posts. He is all that we have that can take up the mainstream media and the narrative that they want to pull that he is racist or xenophobic or whatever else they continue to come up with. And I think it's not about underestimating people in our country, because too many assume you're going to see something in Minnesota, some kind of chaos, and all Hispanic voters will automatically turn against them. That's just not true. People have common sense. People know what they voted for. A lot of the polling is not very accurate. And I think the people of our country are going to look at those numbers before November and actually try to make an informed decision.
What do you think of Vance's performance so far? And what do you think of his political prospects?
You know, I think too many people are trying to turn the page on Donald Trump and talk about J.D. Vance when we're only 1 year in, mostly because they know that they want to get rid of Donald Trump so desperately. It's all they've wanted since 2016. I think he's done a great job, but I think 3 years in American politics, especially in Donald Trump's America, is a very, very long time.
Right.
And there's a lot that's going to change.
Do you think there's going to be a contested primary?
As of right now, I do not. I think J.D. Vance is going to go up and no one's going to run against him. But 3 more years of, you know, foreign policy wins, hopefully, and different, you know, things happening in our country means Donald Trump is going to have to make a decision when he goes out of who's the best person. And
I,
you never know.
I think Ted Cruz is. I think Ted Cruz and Vance have some disagreements. I think he'll end up running. So Gavin Newsom's had a terrible week.
Yes.
Right. And but here's what he said about J.D. Vance. Cut 11.
Vance, for whatever reason, scares me.
Why?
Almost more than Trump. I don't know. I just, I mean, talk about a guy who put a mask on and his face grew into it. I mean, J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio were two of the most effective critics, just like that guy, what's his name, Graham Lindsay, of Donald Trump. What frauds, what phonies. But J.D. is a unique fraud and phony, and he's a little more dangerous. And the folks around him, these are not folks that believe. I mean, listen to some of the, its biggest funders, the way they talk. There's a nihilism to the way they talk about the world. I know these guys.
Okay. Elizabeth?
I mean, that word dangerous, right? They're just trying to set the stage. That means, based on your question,
you
Gavin Newsom believes, of course, that's who his competitor is going to be. And just like they tried against Donald Trump, the only way to beat them when you can't beat them on policies is to beat them on rhetoric and claim that they are dangerous monsters.
So what I think is almost funny is that they want to go back and say they were critics. They were critics for a very short period of time. It's been plowed ground. They were both leading contenders to be the running mate. If you're going to fight that fight, that's a little crazy, but that's what he's doing now. He's trying to look moderate, and he's trying to take on what he thinks is going to be his next opponent. What do you think?
I mean, I saw people on the Democrat side calling Joe Biden a racist and then endorsing him when he became the nominee. So we know that politicians go up against each other.
He became his running mate.
Yeah, exactly. I know politicians attack each other all the time, and I think it means more when they actually had to, you know, decide that Donald Trump was growing on them and come out and apologize and say, now we understand what the American people saw in him and why he's really the most popular person we've had in the GOP for decades. So I think that means more. I don't think this is a very logical fight considering what happens on both sides every election cycle. Again, American people are smarter than what Gavin Newsom gives them credit
for. Some primaries are important. It's got Scott Brown against John Sununu of New Hampshire. The president said John Sununu is my guy. Senator Tim Scott said he's my guy. Is that how that's going to go?
I'm very hopeful. Look, New Hampshire is also a very important state. So I think you have to look at the numbers in New Hampshire.
Possible to flip.
Anything is possible. Unfortunately, especially when Donald Trump is in office and there's so many things that happen in those off years, right? Those midterm years is when everybody comes out based on how much they hate or love the guy in the Oval Office. It happens every 4 years. So anything's possible, but New Hampshire is a state you have to look at because very often New Hampshire also decides the presidential race.
Right. And then when you look around in Texas, the best one to win in the general, they say, is Senator John Cornyn, but he's trailing in the primary. Should the president go in and endorse? Because he's going there Friday.
There's probably a reason he hasn't. I assume he's waiting for something. But yes, the president should endorse, especially in a state like Texas. Every time Donald Trump says something, it matters, either negatively or positively, but it always matters. In this case, it would be pretty obviously a positive.
Who do you think the best candidate is? Ken Paxton, Wesley Hunt, Senator Cornyn?
I will wait for Donald Trump to endorse, and I'll get behind whatever he says.
So you think any three can win?
I do, 100%. I mean, if you look at people, and if you actually talk to people in Texas, they're very, very much supportive of a lot of these candidates, and that's what matters. Considering many have a negative connotation associated with their name, most of these guys are actually pretty well-liked.
People got freaked out 3 weeks ago when that state Senate race, it was 17 points, I think, for Trump, flipped to a Democrat. Were you?
I don't know if freaked out is the right word, but I'm keeping track. I was upset when Miami flipped and created a Democrat mayor as well a couple of weeks ago. This is what people are talking about. I don't know if Republicans realize that the fight continues on. Donald Trump has been fighting our battles literally since 2015, and he's gone up against everything.
And what is that? And you're saying maybe the ripple effect is that people just got used to it.
People got very, very used to it. They don't work as hard. They also get excited knowing that Donald Trump's going to fight the battle for them, and he doesn't have time to go to every single mayoral race and campaign across the country. He needs to run the country, and we need to make sure every single person in every county across America knows why Donald Trump's policies will work for them.
What about money-wise? How's the RNC doing?
Doing well. Look, money is very, very important in politics. However, Donald Trump taught us that money is not everything. He went up against the greatest political machine ever in 2016. But right now, based on the fact Donald Trump's name is still a part of the GOP and the main part of the GOP, money is flowing in because he is incredibly, incredibly popular.
So I want to tell you, do you see strategy in the way people who are center left, you have Carville, Axelrod, and now Fareed Zakaria, all coming out being critical of Democratic policies? And here's an example. Fareed Zakaria on cities, cut 15.
New York is really a prime example of a problem Democrats seem unwilling to confront. Blue cities are out of control, promising more, spending more, delivering less, and pushing off the fiscal problems to some future day. Take Los Angeles, another one-party metropolis wrestling with affordability and disorder. The city's homelessness budget for fiscal year 2025-26 totals about $950 million. The LA Homelessness Services Authority reported that in 2023, homelessness was up 9% countywide and 10% in the city. All this amid public frustration despite billions spent.
So he's right. It's something like you would say, Elizabeth Pipko, about the way Democratic cities are run. Why are they saying it about themselves? Are they just being good analysts trying to up their ratings, or is there something else?
No, I think they're trying to put out a warning. They saw what happened in 24. They're all trying to rewrite history and claim that they saw this coming. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris actually didn't do enough. Now they're worried about midterms and genuinely trying to prove their worth and say that they know that things are not good. Donald Trump is still evil, of course, but Democrats also have to do that audit that they didn't want to release on themselves, figure out why they're not as popular as they pretend that they are, and to try to fix things, because again, they know the American public is smarter than they give them credit for.
So what was it about that audit that they didn't want to release? Are they afraid it's going to remind people of where they fell short?
I can only imagine how bad it looks. Again, we saw the numbers every single day. We were watching the news where they were claiming Kamala Harris and Donald Trump were neck and neck, and we had our own numbers that proved they were not, that she was historically unpopular. She did not have much of a chance. People were very, very upset with that administration and the way that she took over as the, you know, the presidential heir apparently to the throne, and the way that she believed that she was owed all of that. They know that the American people were very upset with them. They don't want to remind anybody of what happened, and they want to bury it, run on the anti-Trump message, and hope again that it works.
So they found that Josh Krasauer wrote that they're finding that Gen Z is extremely anti-Israel.
Yes.
Both parties. It seems like roughly your age bracket.
Yes.
Why?
You know, I think a lot has changed in our world. It's very unfortunate that all of that blame kind of falls on Israel, but I think this is what happens when someone goes in like Donald Trump, tries to change our entire foreign policy strategy and really rattle what we've had going for many, many years. People have to get used to it. They have to relearn what our foreign policy is. Just saying we've stood with Israel historically for decades is not going to work anymore for young people, and that's okay.
Well, why is that? Like, they're not walking going, we got to stop. We don't have to be in NATO anymore. You know, I don't want to have to watch Japan anymore. It's Israel.
It's always Israel. Yeah, look, the internet's a really dangerous place. There's a lot of scary conspiracy theories out there. I think having a president as popular as Donald Trump on the right and standing firm is going to mean something, but it's going to be on, I mean, both sides of the aisle moving forward to make sure that they stand strong and let people know who our allies are and who our enemies are, because it's fine to question where, you know, we give foreign aid and all of that. But what's not fine is to question who your allies are and who your adversaries are, because there's a reason America is who we are. Mm-hmm. There's a reason we have enemies that we share with Israel, and people should understand that.
You personally see the benefit of being allies with Israel?
What, 1,000%. Look, we share an enemy that is Iran. We share intelligence. We share a goal for the United States. We share the fact that we are democracies that want the best for our future. We share basic goals. We share enemies, obviously. And it's common sense to have an ally like Israel in the region that is the Middle East, knowing how many enemies they have out there and we have out
there.
If we
combine again for a sustained attack with Israel and have success in ousting this regime and starting a new chapter in Iran, would that help or hurt Israel's viewed in America?
It could help. It really depends on how it's done. I want to make sure there's not one American soldier on the ground, that it is as quick of an operation as it could possibly be. Hopefully no more protesters, of course, in Iran. They're doing what they want to do, and we're all proud to see them do it. But you want less people to die, and I think the majority of young people are seeing things as black and white. As long as there's no American troops on the ground and it's a quick, swift, successful operation, it should be very good.
Elizabeth Pipko, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. From his-
his mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Yesterday, you called the USA hockey team. They lost in overtime to Canada, but the way they stood up in Canada really stood out and upset the team. They lose in overtime yesterday. What did you say to the USA hockey team? Because they were all motivated afterwards, very patriotic people. And what do you say to Justin Trudeau, who's kind of taunting you afterwards, saying Canada will always be for Canadians and will always, to paraphrase, will always own hockey?
Well, we won the first game. The second game was a great game. It could have gone either way. Justin's a loser, always has been. And, you know, he's just a guy that really doesn't... I think he's done a very bad job for Canada. He's taken it radical left, and he's going to lose the election. It looks like pretty big. It's if he even runs, I don't know.
He's not running.
He's not going to run.
So that was my conversation after the last time the U.S.-Canada played in the tournament, and there was an upset, a great game, and now this time it was reverse. And it's amazing. The Canadians, I'm not saying they're complete. I think the U.S. team has gone out of their way to make it clear that they didn't want to taunt the Canadians. A lot of them are their teammates in the NHL, so they wouldn't. You know, but they wanted the Russians in that tournament, too. They all did, but the Russia's Ukraine, as well as cheating in the Olympics, has combined to not allow them, essentially, to play for their country, but some athletes are allowed to compete. So that was his interview, the president's interview with us after the tournament. And look, president was like, fine, you did the best you can. You lost by a goal. That happens. Then they come back and they win in overtime, even after being shot 2-1. But the comment that he made saying, hey, you know what? I'm going to have to invite the women. You better be okay with that. I don't want to get impeached. People are taking that the wrong way. Why? They don't want the narrative of the president calling up into the locker room, congratulating them. You know who used to do that? Richard Nixon used to do that. You know who used to do that? Ronald Reagan used to do that. That's just off the top of my head. Always calling in. Richard Nixon famously used to give George Allen of the Washington Redskins ideas for plays as if he needed them. That's just what goes on with you know, with US, with the presidents who were sports enthusiasts. So that's just what they do. And this president, he's probably the biggest sports fan and athlete in terms of golf. I mean, he's playing at an extremely high level. So that's what the president does. And why people are saying why to the U.S. hockey, why are you taking his call? Are you crazy? What do you mean, why am I taking the president's call in the locker room? Fareed Zakaria is a big hockey fan. He was invited in there. The big difference between Kash Patel and Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton followed the Women's World Cup team around with Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy and everybody. He went to every game, including the final where they beat China. He went right to the locker room every single time. I'm sure he was having some champagne. I'm sure he had his arm around some players and some coaches. But no one took pictures back then. Phones weren't big back then. Here's Jack Hughes last night, cut 27.
I'm so proud and I'm so happy that the men's and women's USA hockey teams brought gold medals back to the United States of America.
Yep, and that's him, the New Jersey Devils star. They did lose 2-1 in overtime, but Jack was greeted well as the Buffalo Sabres player who's on the national team. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to BrianKilmeade.com, order tickets May 30th in Reno, Nevada, and then in July 11th in Evansville, Indiana, BrianKilmeade.com.